from the Baltimore Sun. And where do they go from here? Most importantly, he is on the Window Nation guest hotline, Jacob Calvin Meyer. Jacob, good morning. Belated Merry Christmas and Happy New Year preemptive. How you doing, man?
Happy holidays, fellow. Thanks for having me on.
All right. What happened? What's the deal with the actual con? Because there's that fine line, Jacob, as you know. Did the Orioles come cheap and he split because they didn't come fair with the deal? Or they offered more than Arizona, which has been reported by a couple of people. He just wanted to go home. Where's the reality here, at least as close to reality as we can get right now, in regards to the Orioles' interest in keeping him around?
Yeah, I understand that's a big focus of the fan base is how much they tried. At the end of the day, of course, it didn't matter because he had, even if they had offered more than 210, he had a clear preference to be close to home. And just one note on that to start with, that not to make excuses for any of the teams that tried to get him and didn't, but this wasn't a minor thing with Corbin Burnes, right? I've only been covering the team for 2 years. But in those 2 years, I don't know if there's a player that is more kind of family oriented or dedicated to his family than Corbin Burnes, who flew home to Arizona after multiple starts, flew in to start the All-Star game the morning of, and then flew home immediately after he left the game. And he's got 3 kids under 3 and all that. So that was an uphill battle to start for the Orioles and really any East Coast team looking to sign him. My understanding, and this is all a guess, right, based on anonymous sources of multiple different reports from different outlets, if you mash all of them together, my understanding of it is that the Orioles offered what would have been a franchise record contract, so more than $161 million that they gave to Chris Davis, and that worked out great, didn't it? But less than the $210 that Arizona gave. That's my understanding of all the reports. That doesn't mean that that's necessarily the facts of what happened. We're probably never going to know exactly what the Orioles' offer was, but it looks like the Blue Jays offered something in the 7 for $250 range, and he turned that down. That's obviously $40 million more than what he got from Arizona and a higher annual average value. And so, listen, you have to play with the hands that you're dealt. I know Mike Elias loves to move the left field wall in and out, but you can't move the franchise and move him to Arizona to get Corbin Burnes unless – John Angelos wants to come back and move his team to Nashville. But listen, it was an uphill battle from the start. But my understanding of all the reports, if you mash them together, is that the Orioles made an offer that didn't really seem to be as competitive as what Arizona ended up offering. And then San Francisco and the Blue Jays both offered, it seems, more than $210 million.
Based on your experience covering him for that 1 year, Jacob, if the Orioles offer, and again, we don't know what it really was until Boris or Burnes himself tells the world, which I don't think they will. If it was similar, if not exceeded Arizona, were they still kind of at a disadvantage because he just wanted to be around it? Look, he's in Arizona where he lives. Spring training's in Arizona. I mean, duh, kind of makes sense, right? And they're good. Yeah, they're not bad. They're not a bad team either.
Well, in fact, you could probably say, not to take an unnecessary shot, but that Arizona might be the best rebuild of this decade ahead of the Orioles, right? Just a couple of years ago, the same year as the Orioles, they lost 108 games. 2 years later, they make the World Series, and now they're out here spending money. And so, Arizona's no slouch. It's not like he went to, he chose to go to some crappy team just because it's close to home. My guess, again, this is really just a guess, knowing Corbin Burnes a little bit, is that he really wanted to be on the West Coast. And it seems like Arizona is really where he wanted to be. And so the negotiations with teams on the East Coast were probably just to get Arizona to pay as much as Arizona was willing to pay. And so if you get the Blue Jays to offer $250 million and maybe you get the Orioles to offer something that is perhaps less than $210 million, but maybe the average, the yearly salary would be more than what he ended up getting from Arizona, you can use those two offers to get Arizona to bring more to the table. That's my guess. Listen, that doesn't mean that the Orioles could not sign Corbin Burnes, but I think a lot of the frustration from the fan base, which is generally understandable considering how difficult it's been to be a fan of this organization for the past 4 decades, isn't just about Corbin Burnes. It's about the fact that we're about to head into the new year and Zach Eflin and Grayson Rodriguez are still the number one and number two starters on this team, despite the fact that there were a ton of starting pitchers on the market that they could have gone after, and it doesn't seem like they were able to land any of them.
You must be reading my mind, because my next question, Jacob Calvin-Meyer from the Baltimore Sun, A, where do the Orioles go from here, looking for a starting pitcher or two to supplement the rotation, and back to this whole same old Orioles narrative where they're not really trying to win, it's all smoke and mirrors. So where do you stand on both of those subjects right now?
Yeah, this whole offseason, I've been trying to take a wider lens to it, which is getting me, a lot of people are mad at me in my mentions on social media and via email for not, just going all in and saying that this has been a terrible offseason, because, I'm old enough to remember 10 months ago when they didn't go out in the offseason and get an ace starting pitcher, and then February 1st, they trade for Corbin Burnes, and it changed the entire complexion of the offseason, and a lot of the people, including myself, last offseason, who were saying, oh, they're not going to do this, they're not going to go all in, they're not going to get an ace, blah, blah, blah. Those people ended up being wrong. And so there's still about 6 weeks left in this offseason. And if you go back, hindsight's 2020, but with the way that this offseason has played out, with every pitcher essentially getting not overpaid, but more than what they were projected, Max Fried has a forearm issue and he gets $218 million. Corbin Burnes, who's outstanding, his strikeout rate has declined in four straight seasons. He gets $210 million. Blake Snell pitches five innings a start. He gets $180-some million, right? It's like all of these guys are getting a lot of money. If you go back and look at that, and then you look and you say, oh, there's 10 to 12 pitchers who would profile as either a number one or number two starter who are all available on the trade market, I would say, even though I know people want them to spend money, and at some point they're going to have to spend money if they want to be true contenders, year after year, that's just the only way it can work in baseball. This offseason, it might make more sense to go out and get somebody via trade. It doesn't have to be a one-year rental like Corbin Burnes was. There are pitchers. Luis Castillo has 2 years of team control. I think Bryce Miller has 4 years of team control. Mitch Keller has 5 years of team control. There's a ton of these guys. The Orioles have some excess bats. Ryan Mountcastle's been somebody who's been rumored in trades for years. Heston Kerstad, Kobe Mayo, they can part ways with one or two of those guys. They also have depth in the farm system and go out and get a starting pitcher. If tomorrow the Orioles go out and trade for Luis Castillo or Bryce Miller and you slot that guy atop the Orioles rotation, it's not replacing Corbin Burnes, right? There's only about seven or eight pitchers of Corbin Burnes' caliber, but it would completely change the makeup of the offseason. And so I'm not just going to kind of overreact and say, oh, they didn't do enough this offseason, because it's just not over yet.
Jacob Calvin-Meyer, Baltimore Sun, Jack Flaherty, reunion real or no?
Yeah, could you imagine? Could you imagine?
No, six months ago? No.
Yeah, but it's like the Orioles fans are so desperate that whether or not they consider this to be a good offseason is whether Mike Elias gives Jack Flaherty $100 million. It would surprise me, frankly. The vibes were just not great when he was here. There's been some talk about him being kind of out of gas when they traded for him, which is funny because the next year they trade for Trevor Rogers, who was also out of gas. Mm. So I would, either they need to build a gas station near Camden Yards, or they need to, acquire pitchers who, have more than, a half a tank. But no, listen, if they don't think that they can get somebody via trade, then Jack Flaherty is really the only guy left that makes sense at all, right? He profiles as more of a number two starter than a true number one. But that would give the Orioles three number two quality starters in Eflin and Flaherty and Grayson. And while that's not ideal, you do have Bradish coming back, potentially late in the season. That rotation is more than good enough with this offense to make the postseason. People forget the Orioles won 101 games 2 years ago without Corbin Burnes. So it's not like the season's over or everything's dead. My guess, though, is that I think it makes a lot more sense that they can that they go out and acquire somebody via trade, perhaps a starting pitcher who has multiple years of team control. That's my guess. And if they don't do that, if they go into spring training with Zach Eflin and Grayson Rodriguez as the number one and number two starter on this team, then the front office deserves all the criticism that they're getting right now. But again, there's still 6 weeks left. And we saw what happened last offseason.
Agreed. Jacob Calvin-Meyer, Baltimore Sun. Jacob, appreciate the time as always. Again, Happy New Year, you and the family, and we'll talk to you in 2025, hopefully talking about a well-fortified Orioles roster as they head to Sarasota.
Thanks, guys. Always a pleasure.
You got it. Here's Jacob Calvin-Meyer. We'll come back, whip around. Chris Nockey's going to be joining us, bottom of the hour. Talk some Maryland hoops with him. The prelims are over. All about the main events now as the Big Ten schedule starts to really tip off in earnest. Funhouse Trip, Nolan McGraw, take your phone calls at 410-583-1057. News from the Nest coming up at noon. Bob Haney, Nolan McGraw, Vinny and Haney, 1057 The Fan.
Vinny and Haney's Whip. Brought to you by Fox Hill Pizzeria and Crab Cakes. The best crab cakes in Harford County. 1057 The Fan.
1057 The Fan. Time for the whip around here on this Monday. A lot going on in the world of sports over the weekend, and we'll get to some of the happenings. But college football playoffs resume tomorrow, New Year's Eve. Penn State, number 6, taking on Boise State. That's in the Fiesta Bowl. 11.5-point spread in favor of the Nittany Lions. Then on Wednesday, New Year's Day, Texas taking on Arizona State. That's in the Peach Bowl. Texas 12.5-point favorites. Ohio State, Oregon, a rematch of their game earlier in the season, won by the Ducks. That one is at the Rose Bowl, old school Rose Bowl matchup there. Buckeyes 2.5-point favorites. And then Notre Dame taking on Georgia Sugar Bowl. The Dogs, 1.5-point favorites over the Fighting Irish. So that is all coming your way this week. College football playoffs trimming it down to the Final Four. So going to be an interesting couple of days here in the world of college football. NBA last night, Atlanta 136-107 over Toronto. Trae Young had 34 for the Hawks. Bruno Fernando, Emmanuel Quickley from Baltimore, Bruno from Maryland, both sat it out with injuries. Quickley's been hurt for pretty much the majority of the season. Miami beat Houston 104-100. There was a brawl at the end of the game. Tyler Hero, he's played hero ball on the floor, and then they were fisticuffing. A lot of ejections going on there. Haywood Highsmith for the Heat. Baltimore, Archbishop Curley, 15 points, 8 rebounds, 2 assists. Cam Whitmore for the Rockets. Baltimore, Spalding. Villanova, 7 points, 3 boards there. It was Oklahoma City, 130-106 over Memphis. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Nolan, 35 points, 6 rebounds, 7 assists. Aaron Wiggins, Terps, 16 points for the Thunder. Santi Aldama is having a really good year for the Grizzlies. He sat this one out. He hurt his ankle a couple of games ago, so he could be on the shelf for a while there for the old Grizzlies. College hoops men, Saturday, Maryland 81-66 over UMES. We'll talk about that with Chris Nockey coming up in a couple of minutes. Julian Reese, 23-11. Derek Queen, 18-14. Big Ten last night. Oregon, number 9, who Maryland will face next Sunday. They beat Weber State, 89-49. Number 21, Purdue. They beat Toledo, 83-64. Number 24, Illinois, beat Chicago State, 117-64. Also in the Big Ten, local interest here, Minnesota beats Morgan, 90-68. William & Mary, we bring it back closer to home, 82-76 over Navy. And UMBC, double overtime over American U, coached by former Terp Dwayne Simpkins, 96-93. On the ice last night, Detroit beat the Caps 4-2 as Alexander Ovechkin returns to the ice and scored a goal, 870 on his career. But another Alex Debrincat had 2 goals for the Red Wings. Caps will play tomorrow, New Year's Eve, taking on the Bruins. That's a 12:30 puck drop, so a little early ice hockey for you there. It's a whip around, Vinny and Andy, 1057 The Fan. Real quick, this day in sports history, 2018, M&T Bank Stadium. Today is December the 30th. That would be 6 years ago. Lamar Jackson's rookie season, and he continued to do things that helped the Ravens get into the playoffs.
And here we open up the second with a Jackson key. Jackson dunks to the end zone for the touchdown. A 4th and 10, and here they come. Mayfield's pass is intercepted by Mosley, and the Ravens are going to take the division.
Playoff clinching win at that, 26-24. Ravens beat the Browns. Justin Tucker kick four field goals. C.J. Mosley, and I guess his penultimate game in Baltimore. He played in the playoffs and then signed with the Jets as a free agent, coming up with a huge play there. Two rookie quarterbacks getting on Baker Mayfield, who threw five touchdowns yesterday, which we'll get to when we get to the NFL lunch. And Lamar Jackson, exciting game. Ravens win 6 years ago today to clinch the AFC North, which they can do again Saturday against the Cleveland Browns. And obviously, we will talk about that throughout the course of the week. We'll talk about it later in the show, as a matter of fact, with both Howard Balzer, longtime NFL writer, and Kyle Goon from the Baltimore Banner. But when we come back, a little Maryland hoops. You've been paying attention to what Willard's got going on down at College Park? Well, you better be. Jerry Palm thinks Maryland's one of the best teams in the Big Ten. They haven't beaten a ranked team yet. They got an opportunity next week against Oregon, but we'll talk about that more with Chris. Funhouse trip, phone calls, and a lot going on here. It's a Monday, no real musical theme. Corbin Burns is gone, and it's got some people running out. Now the Big Ten schedule starts to really percolate, and here to talk about that as only he can. He's on the Window Nation guest hotline. Let's welcome to the show. From the Maryland Radio Network, he is our friend and yours, everybody, Chris Nockey. Chris, good morning. Appreciate the time. And is today your birthday?
No. Yesterday was.
Oh. Well, happy belated birthday, then. I didn't want to.
Hey, thanks, man. I appreciate it.
I didn't want to bring you on minus a cupcake. You know what I mean? But speaking of cupcakes.
Up all night baking, right?
Yeah, no doubt. It would have been more like a hostess, but it is what it is. 13 games in, and yeah, there were some cupcakes on the schedule. That's kind of the landscape of college basketball. It always has been. I seem to remember, you know, Big John and the Hoyas going through the entire state of Hawaii in their preseason sort of get ready for the season slate. But what's the biggest thing, Chris, through the 13 games that stands out to you from a positive standpoint about this team and why they're different than last year's disappointing year?
I'll give you kind of a 1A and 1B. The first is they really, I think, did well. It hit the jackpot, really, with the guards they brought in. They completely, it appears that they completely solved all the issues last year with not being able to shoot the ball. They've got weapons on the outside now, multiple weapons on the outside. The point guard play has been pretty much flawless with Jacoby Gillespie, just as solid as could be. The other thing is, I think that we've been able to, after 13 games, it's pretty apparent that Julian Reese and Derek Queen can play together. You know, I mean, that's always one of those things you're not really sure about. You don't have many situations or many teams that play multiple big guys, you know, two big guys at the same time. So it will always be a work in progress, but they seem to have a certain chemistry to them. And obviously that's a big question answered right there.
Now, Chris, we'll start with Julian Reese, cause he's the senior and, you know, he's had his moments of brilliance and consistencies. Foul trouble tends to get to him. Hadn't been all that great from the foul line throughout his career, even though that's gotten better in a big way in 2024, soon to be 25. Just talking about him physically, though. When he first walked into the College Park campus to where he is now, from a physical presence standpoint, how much more imposing is he than he was?
Yeah, and he's played a lot of minutes, you know. And he's a dependable rim protector, shot blocker, and, you know, he definitely has a defensive presence to him. I tell you what I like best about him is, not the physical growth, it's really the maturity, it's the mental growth. You know, when he was a freshman, he took slights personally. If somebody bumped him or ran into him or talked a little trash to him, it always got under his skin, you know, very short-tempered. And you don't see that at all anymore. That's gone by the wayside. And it makes him obviously a much more effective player when he can focus on the game as opposed to the peripheral stuff. And I think that's been the most significant part of his growth.
Now with Derek Queen, he comes in with all the 5-star McDonald's All-American accolades, and you knew the rep was obviously there, but has he exceeded even your, and you've played the game, you've coached the game, you've been around it forever, as you are a Hall of Famer, of course, but is he even better than advertised, Derek Queen, at least based on what we've seen so far?
I will say when he's at his best, he's better than advertised. I will say this, and this is picking nits, right? But I like the other night they're playing, and it was a game against UMES. I think the Terps pretty much could have named their final score. their margin of victory. But, you know, when great players sometimes, and I always kid my guy Walt Williams, who's on our broadcast team, obviously, about this. Sometimes the things come so easily to you that you coast. You just sort of, you know, you're not really playing, giving it your all. You're right, basically, you go through the motions a little bit. And even with that, great players can still get, you know, 20 and 10. I think Derek does that sometimes too. And I thought we saw that in the first half against UMES. I think Willard lit him up at halftime. He didn't start the second half. And yet, still, at the end of the game, I think he had 18 points and 12 rebounds or 14 rebounds, something like that, which tells me he did that all in one half, pretty much. So, you know, when he's really into it and playing hard, and I know he's a big-time player when the real lights are on. Up at Barclays, he was fantastic, and, of course, against Marquette, he was great. I'm not worried about those games, but you just in the Big Ten, there are no nights off, and we'll find that out for sure on Thursday in Seattle. You got to play and play 40.
Chris Nockey, Maryland Radio Network, joining us here on the Fan. Bob Haney with you, talking about the Terps, 11-2, right there on the fringe of the top 25, 26 last week. Rankings come out later today. You mentioned Washington. That's coming up Thursday night there. And then Oregon, ranked number 9 in the country, coming up Sunday on Peacock at 4 o'clock. For them to, you know, they play with Marquette. My opinion, Chris, should have beat Purdue. I mean, it is what it is. But how do they come back 2-0? What's going to be the main thing that Oregon and then the Huskies are going to throw at them to try to, you know, continue that rough stretch on the road if it becomes one?
And I think that one of the things they're going to have to do is they're going to have to shoot the ball well. I think that's critical. I think they're going to see a lot of zone on this trip from both teams. Dana Altman in Oregon mixes and matches defenses as well as anybody in the country, and he's got some guys. You know, he's got some really good players. But I think the Terps are going to – I think that their reputation precedes them, and I think teams are going to try and take away Julian Reese and Derek Queen around the basket. So when they do that and collapse like that and drop to the level of the ball, it's imperative the guys step up and make shots, whether it's starting lineup or guys coming off that bench. You have to be consistent, I think, from the perimeter.
All right, Chris, last thing for you. We had Jerry Palm from CBSSports.com on last week, and he thinks Maryland's really good, could be one of the four best teams in the Big Ten before it's all said and done. We certainly don't want to get that far ahead, but what's the ceiling for this team as we head into 2025?
I think they've got a tremendous ceiling, and I tell you what, I'm hoping that they can win. There is nothing like winning a game on the road. And particularly against top-level competition. So I think that this team will really go into hyperdrive if you're able to win, you know, like in a situation like at Oregon, at Illinois. We're at Illinois here very shortly. At Indiana, same thing. I think those kind of wins are invaluable, and that's when you're going to find out about the ceiling, because I think that the light bulb will go on and these guys we'll understand just how good they are.
Chris Nockey, Maryland Radio Network. One more time, Chris, belated happy birthday. Happy New Year to you and the family. Good seeing you, by the way, a couple of days ago.
Yeah,
always great to catch up. Very excited about the prospects for this year's team, and we'll be talking about with you in 2025.
Thanks, Bob.
You got it, buddy. Here's Chris Nockey, everybody. It's Vinny and Haney, 105.7 The Fan. Bob Haney, Nolan McGraw, if you're on the phone, we'll squeeze in a couple of calls. Then we'll get to the fun house with Nolan. NFL lunch coming up, or news from the Nest, rather, coming up top of the hour. We're going to hear from Kyle Van Noy. He's had a big old season for these Baltimore Ravens. We'll count that early week money, end of the year money, I guess, with buy or sell. And longtime NFL writer Howard Balzer tries to make sense of the Week 18 slate and all these zany playoff scenarios. A couple of fancy names got eliminated from postseason hope last night. We'll get into all of that and more here on The Fan. Remember, seemed like just yesterday, but back in September, he was the defensive player of the month with 6 sacks, now over double figures. Another thing that kind of hits you when it comes to the end of the year, only 1 week left in the NFL season. Only one more red zone. That's it. And we're Scott Hansen after Sunday, Nolan.
Some people are kind of done with red zone now. Wow. I mean, it's no longer commercial free. That was the thing a week or so ago. Scott Hansen opened up red zone. What's the famous line? Now starts, 7-8 hours, whatever it is.
Commercial free
football,
et cetera.
That's the tagline. A couple weeks ago, they slipped ads in while they're showing highlights, maybe like a split screen situation, or they'll cut away to a standalone 30-second spot or something like that. And Hansen opened the show, I think last week, said, now start 7 hours of football coverage or something of that nature.
Did not notice that.
Yeah. Now, people on social media were very up in arms.
I'm kind of bummed, too. But anyway, when Scott Hansen signs off at the end of next Sunday, we won't be hearing him in the red zone world until next September.
Right. Well, Scott Hansen's a robot, so they just kind of power him off.
That's how it is.
Yeah, he's like an animatronic. He just kind of stands there. He's always behind the desk.
All right, let's get out to the phones. If we don't have time for a fun house, we'll do it next hour. But news from the Nest coming up. Bob Haney, Nolan McGraw. Ravens play Saturday, 4:30 at home against Cleveland. Ravens win. They win the AFC North. They are 18-point favorites. And Lamar trying to do whatever he can to hopefully win his third most valuable player and become one of the rare players to win back-to-back. Sean in Minnesota. Sean, thanks for holding. What's up? Sean. Yeah, no Sean. All right, let's go to Chris and Arnold. Chris, what's going on?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. It's this is my third year with a 29 game plan with the Orioles, and this offseason makes me not want to renew so far for next year if they don't do anything or make any significant moves. It would be nice if they can't get a pitcher, like Bregman's still out there, Alonzo's still out there. If you can't get pitchers, get some hitters that can score runs and put up a lot of runs, so maybe we have a chance to offset our pitchers not being able to make it deep into games, because with this current lineup, we knew what we had with the injuries last year. I see a similar type of thing happening again this year where we can't have a full roster or a full healthy season with our pitchers. Like, it's just, I don't know. It's the same old, you know. It's like with the new owner, we think things would be different, but it's just, we've had 40 years of bad baseball. I'm 34. The Orioles have been bad for a majority of my life, and when they finally have a chance to be good, and the World Series window is going to close, because in all reality, are they going to sign Gunner? Are they going to trade him away like they did Manny? Like, it's just a lot of uncertainty with the Orioles, and it would just be nice for Elias to make fans have more faith in the team and be like, we're in it to win now, not develop players and have another liftoff in 4 years when we have to wait for the prospects to get up to the big leagues, because not all the prospects are going to make it to the big leagues. And it's just, I don't know. It would be nice for the Orioles to win the World Series, but with this current roster, I don't really see them winning more than 80 games. What do you guys think?
All right, Chris, thanks for the call. And I understand your frustration, because Nolan's kind of in the same boat you are age-wise, a little younger. But winning seasons have been few and far between since the Orioles last won the World Series. And off the top of my head, winning years in 83, 84, 85, but not really contenders. 89, they were contenders. That came out of nowhere. It did not sustain itself. 92, 93, 94, good teams. Strike year, I think, boned them in there, because, you know, Messina was having a brilliant season. They had MVP-level guys. I mean, but then again, that was a strike year. 96, 97 made the ALCS. Chris was a baby. You weren't even born. Or you were. You were drooling all over yourself. Then they sucked for 14 years. Got good in 12. Come out of nowhere. 14 won the division. Banged up in the ALCS. Got swept by the Royals. 16 won and done with the play-in game, if you want to call it that. Here's your window. It's wide open. There's potential to be good. But I don't know if you heard earlier, Chris, when we were talking, if the roster, and with all due respect, PT, because I hear you working with that positivity, a lot of ifs and buts and candies and nuts in your scenario, this roster, the way it's put together on the next to last day of 2024, my humble opinion, unless, but now, see, I'm going to get an ifs and buts. 88 wins? You're regressing now from 101 to 90 to... You're going the wrong way, as they said, in planes, trains, and automobiles, not moving up even higher into the echelon of where we hoped you would be in the American League East, where you would think they got good in 22, Remember, there was a day, literally a day in like late August, where if the playoffs would have started, they would have qualified. And then ran away with the division in 23. But by this stage, instead of angst and hand-wringing and who's going to be the opening day starter, we'd be, hey, man, the Orioles, why aren't they the favorites to win the World Series? And they're not that right now.
Right.
They're not favorites to win their division, much less the World Series.
They've exhausted the goodwill that comes with the initial bounce back and the rebuild. When you finally get back to winning, there is that kind of honeymoon phase where the team can do no wrong. They're winning most nights. That's good enough. The energy's back in the fan base. But it runs out. And it has run out. It ran out last year. All of a sudden, now the expectations are there. Now, as you were saying, it's not just good enough to simply be a competitive team. You have to be a World Series caliber team. And as far as the fan base angst, look, I'm right there with you. But this isn't just about Corbin Burns. The Corbin Burns things, it stinks. No two ways about it. You lost a Cy Young caliber guy. But to me, this is bigger than that. You've subtracted more than you've added this offseason so far. That's just a fact. Your subtractions, again, are big losses, not just Burns, but how about your bullpen? How are you going to replace Coulomb and Webb? You know, can you get a significant upgrade on that? Can you lean on Felix Bautista on the back end? I mean, again, there's just so much more work to be done that even if they do trade for a starting pitcher, they sign a free agent, whatever their method is to acquire pitching, there's still so much work to be done. And that's why I'm kind of with you. Right now, as it's constructed, this roster looks like a regression.
Yeah, and I don't want to pee on the Tyler O'Neill cornflakes here, but this guy's had two good years. And the other ones are injury-plagued. And he was on the shelf two or three times for the Red Sox last year.
Mm-hmm.
And his gold gloves, which are, hey, that's on the resume, 5-6 years ago now.
Exactly.
Not like it was last year. So you lost an all-star right fielder who drove in 100 runs and hit 44 jacks. You lost the starting pitcher of the all-star game. Yeah, Bautista was the best closer in baseball 2 years ago. Again, if you think he's duplicating that, I hope he does, by the way. I'm skeptical. Look, Dominguez and Soto, they've got track records, and they're still part of the equation. So I don't know. I think offensive potential's great, perhaps, because Mullins is going to be good all year long, I hope, instead of 2 months or, you know, a half a season, whatever it was. Gunner's MVP ceiling is still very much alive. Adley Rutschman was an all-star worthy catcher in the first half of the season, the exact opposite of that in the second half. Westberg, another all-star, he's a stud. Oh, and by the way, Jackson Holliday a year ago this time was the number one prospect in baseball. He sucks all of a sudden? Let's pump the brakes just a little bit. There's still potential for them to be good. And they followed up the 101 for 2.5 months, being arguably the best team in baseball. And then injuries, inconsistencies, and all sorts of things kind of all hit them. Injuries with the rotation, all kind of hit them all at the same time. So there's still potential, but to my point, to yours, and I guess I speak for a lot of people out there, and now 2 years after 23, you're looking at, oh, the odds have the Orioles the favorite to win the World Series, instead of being like, I mean, they're in the top 10.
Right. And a win total, I don't know. That's not the most important thing in the world. Last year should have taught you that first and foremost. I mean, you couldn't follow up 100 wins, even if the Orioles were at their best last year where they didn't have the second half slump. Would they have reached 100 wins?
They were on pace to win 108 games at one point in the season.
So, again, it's still a rare feat. It's not something you should expect, but it's about what shape is the team in September heading into the most important part of the season. Do you have health? Are your best players trending up rather than trending down? The Orioles didn't have that last year. They had zero health luck. Their best players weren't playing their best at the right time, and it led to the quick exit the year prior, even when they won 100 games. You get punched in the face right out the gate in the playoffs, you know? It happens. So I don't care how many games they win. They just have to be in the dance and be trending in the right direction when they get to September.
Well, I'll point this out, too, not to end the second hour in a bummer. The Orioles have played four home playoff games in the last 2 years. They've lost all of them. Coming up next, news from the Nest. Hey, here's positive. How about a AFC North Championship at home against Cleveland? I could feel that one.